God through knowledge, through intelligence. And this definition is not my definition, it's the Torah's definition. As the Torah says in Deuteronomy 4:6, it says, "And you shall keep them, meaning the commandments, and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, who shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." So Maimonides uses this as his barometer, by the way, and he mentions that in his introductory remarks here, that the Torah itself gave us the best barometer of what it is, because it states that it is your wisdom and your understanding, and other nations will see that this is wise and intelligent. Therefore, he says, any idea that is not wise and intelligent, that cannot be presented to an intelligent person and will not evoke a response from the intelligent, a favorable response from the intelligent person, then you should know that that definitely cannot be Torah. I gave a class last week to our high school, the high school in our area, and after I got finished, one of the youngsters, a high school student, came over to me and he asked me about some mystical idea. So I told him, I said, no, we don't believe in that. So then he proceeded to ask me, well, why? So I said, why? Because it is stupid, and we do not believe in stupidity. And that's not my idea. It's the Torah's idea. The Torah says that is the barometer. Anything which cannot be accepted by an intelligent person cannot be correct. Torah is constructed in a way that it appeals to the most intelligent human mind. Of course, I mean, the person has to study. You can't just present the law to a person and say, do you like it? They have to study the law and see exactly what it is and understand it. Nothing is, it's not simple, but it's intelligent. Now, the thing is that last week, I'm going to use this as a little introduction, but I'd like to get back to what we said last week. Now, I understand that some people were disturbed by the idea that, about this candy bar idea. Now, just let me explain something. Maimonides uses a candy bar in his parable, but of course, it doesn't have to be a candy bar. Oh, there's a reason why he uses that, but in a parable, you don't have to stick to the exact case. He used it in order to make things simple. But of course, I mean, you have to realize that when raising children, the ultimate candy bar for the child is really the love of the parent, or the avoidance of the parent withdrawing their love. Okay, so that is also that's really the ultimate candy bar, therefore, it is virtually impossible. When you train children, and children want to do things in order to please you, that's very nice and necessary. But of course, that's not the ultimate reason. The ultimate reason to serve God is not to make your parents happy, but it's because of the truth itself. But this concept of doing things because of the truth itself is a concept that a person cannot have at a very young age. A 5-year-old, a 6-year-old cannot understand what that means, and therefore, in order to draw them to the proper life, in order to train them, it's necessary to use ulterior motives. Even a grown-up person, to say that they're interested in truth, for the sake of truth itself, that certainly is possible and is admirable. But even there, we have variations of degrees among people. There are some people that are really interested in truth for truth's sake. Other people may be partially motivated by that, partially motivated by something else. I mean, I know a friend of mine is a physicist, and he said at first he went into that field because he figured, look, studying God's universe, what could be more beautiful than that? And he was sure he'd find very ethical people among the physicists. But he was in for a big surprise, because he found that people who study physics were really interested in getting to the credits for it, and et cetera, et cetera. So we were surprised to find that even there, most people were not really involved in uncovering the ideas of God's universe for its own sake, but they had ulterior motives. They wanted to gain some kind of fame or popularity or a good position with their discoveries. Albert Einstein, of course, was a man of a very high high caliber, and he always used to say that a person who makes a discovery, he already received his reward. His reward is the discovery and the knowledge itself. Accolades are not necessary. But now you're talking about a very high-level person. And in between, there are different shades of people, okay? So when we talk about an ultimate concept over here, we have to recognize we're in order to make things more graphic, to demonstrate them, it's always easier to give a parable and extremes, because when you give extremes, you can easily identify what you're talking about. But you have to understand that in real life, it's not extremes, but there are various shades. And that really is a major part of the process of perfecting oneself. That is, that a person should reach a level where the only thing they care about is the truth itself. Okay? And that's why, as I mentioned last week, in Torah, even though one has knowledge of God's existence, and one is not does not believe in God, so to speak, as a faith kind of thing, but he has knowledge of God's existence. He knows that God exists. His mind has gained enough knowledge in order that conclusion registers clearly in his mind. So then, belief is not really a part of his religious composition. It's knowledge. It's like you wouldn't say a physicist believes in physics. He knows physics. A mathematician knows mathematics. And that really is the goal of Torah. The first commandment is to know that God exists, not to believe that God. Belief is really a low level. Knowledge is a much higher level. But even when one has reached that knowledge, he still is not finished, because then the perfecting of the self first begins, and the person has to work on their own emotions, and they have to be able to arrive at a level where really all they're interested is in truth itself, for its own sake, not for any kind of recognition, not for any kind of admiration, just because they value the fact that they are living in the true world, in God's world. And that is all they need. They don't need anything else. A person who is on such a level, as you will understand, does not really experience very much frustration, because with the good is readily available to them, and they are constantly involved in it, and they're constantly in a state of bliss, because that which they truly want is available to them, and there is very little frustration involved in life. So that kind of existence is really the most superior existence, and those people who have experienced that existence are the only ones that really have knowledge of what it's like. Most people are too far removed even from that world, and they have a difficult time even envisioning it. And now, what I would like to do is by the way, the reason why Maimonides gives the candy bar example, if you take a careful look at his example, he has four examples. First, he gives the candy bar. Then he gives, the second thing is the clothing. The third thing is money. And the last is praise and admiration. And the reason why he does that is because, parenthetically, he's showing you which parts of man's emotions are more basic and primary, and which are secondary and are more developed. So he shows you the first most basic desire of man is for the physical, that's the food, the candy bar, so to speak. The next is for for a little psychological pleasure. Psychological pleasure is clothing. You have to be a little older for that, okay? Then the third is money and power. And the fourth, which is the ego itself. The ego itself. That is the most powerful. People will give away money in order to gain ego, just like many politicians will put down millions of dollars in order to get an important office, because that really is the most powerful drive in man, without a doubt. And Maimonides gives that. That's why he gives that elaborate martial parable, because he is parenthetically showing you how man's drives set themselves up. Okay, I just want to show you that when a wise person gives a parable, and when Maimonides writes, every step is accounted for. If you look into it carefully, there are no extra steps there, and the parable itself is worked out specifically to give you knowledge of what is primary in man's desires and what is secondary and more developed and more powerful. Okay, now. He'll come back to that also. You'll see a little later as to why he does that. Okay, let me take up something else. Now, the next step that I'm taking up is a little bit on the abstract side, but I think if I didn't take it up, I would not be doing the subject matter justice. Okay? What we're saying at this point is that there is a part of man that does partake of the eternal, and that is his intelligence. With intelligence, man tunes into a different world, a world that's beyond the physical world, and this world becomes very real to him, even more real than the physical world. Like to a physicist, the equations and the ideas of the universe are more real than the actual physical objects, because physical objects come and go, but the equations determine eternal laws. So, to a person in thought, the ideas have more reality to him or her, and they have more reality, and they sort of move out of the regular kind of reality that most people live in, all right? And they live in a different kind of reality, and they sense that it's more real. It reminds me of what there's a book written by Einstein and Infeld on the development of physics, and he speaks about the concept of a field, which is something which cannot be seen. But he says to the physicist, it's as real as the chair a person is sitting on. And that is true, and that is true in the world of Talmud as well. To the Talmudic scholar, the ideas behind the laws are more real than the actual laws themselves. I'll give you a statement from my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, which he mentioned one time on the 9th of Av, which is a day of mourning, as you know, for the destruction of the temple. So he said that, he says, for me, mourning over the temple takes on a different form, he says. Because for me, the temple is alive and well. I know the ideas of the temple. I've studied the tractate of Zvachim, Menachos, Yuma, and all the ideas of the temple are real in my mind as if the temple exists. So he says, for me, it's not that kind of a loss, of a physical loss. He says, If I had to right now, I could do all the avoda, the holy work that's done in the temple on Yom Kippur from beginning to end without flinching, because everything is before my mind's eye clearly. So for the scholar, it's a different kind of experience than for the layman. I mean, the Torah caters to both, but the essence of Torah always resides in the scholars, in the scholarship, and that's the place from where the halacha always comes from. That's from Zion shall go forth Torah. It means the from the Sanhedrin, they're the wise men, the ones that have the knowledge, they are the source. But of course, the practices are appreciated by everyone, but the scholar has a different view of the world of Torah, just like a physicist has a different view of the physical world than a plain average layman. It's a different kind of an experience. As Rabbi Soloveitchik says, the temple for me is still alive and well. I enjoy the beauty of all the ideas behind the physical structure. So that is real to me. It's real, it exists. That's a concept that may be hard to appreciate, but it's one which I think is important to keep in one's, before one's mind. You know, in Torah, we have the principle that even though we may not be on the highest level, but we should study the higher levels, and even the highest level. Even though we study the actions of a very great person in Abraham, we're not on that level, but we must keep that before our mind's eye, so we have the model of greatness, even though we aren't on that level. But that's part of development, to keep those ideas in front of us. So it's important to recognize the fact that the world of the scholar is not the same as the world of the layman. Of course, other religions, you know, did not really appreciate that idea, and they try to say just the opposite, that the simpleton is really the ideal. Torah does not believe that. Torah never has believed that. And the prophets and the Torah itself and the proverbs and etc. I mean, always single out this point that the knowledge is the essence. Now let me just continue with the point that I want to get at. And that is, we're going to head into a bit of an abstract point here. And that is that we explained that the idea of the soul is that part of man that can appreciate the eternals. The eternals meaning the ideas. That's the part of man which is partaking of the eternal, which proves that there must be something inside of him that is eternal, otherwise he wouldn't have that tool. Okay? Now, the part that survives the physical body is precisely that part. Now, I'm going to go into a question. You see, the point you have to remember also is that the Torah is not a book of sensationalism. The Torah is really a book which presents ideas in two levels. In a basic way, if you read it casually, and yet if you read it carefully, the scholar sees deeper ideas. But it does not cater to sensationalism. Most people are into sensationalism. Like people want to know, well, at the time of the resurrection, how will people get up? With their clothes on, their clothes off, you know? Or what if a person was a cripple? Will they get up healed or not healed? These are the kind of questions that people ask. What are we going to do in the afterlife? They're concerned about, well, will we know our friends? Will we not know our friends? Will we have family? Not have family. Do we know what's going on Earth, or we don't know what's going on Earth? These are interesting kind of questions, but the kind, you know, they're questions that laymen always preoccupy themselves with. Scholars really go for the more meaty points and actually leave these things. Because a scholar knows that you may not be able to ascertain details, but in many of these areas, especially the area of an afterlife, which is an abstract area, but the scholar knows that it's important to say I don't know, just like it's important to say I do know. So let's forget about these little points that we don't know, and let's see what we do know. What we can know is the concept, as I mentioned before, that there is a part of man which partakes of the eternal. That is demonstrable. Let's be happy with that bit of knowledge. But there is something more which Maimonides goes into, and it has to do with the enjoyment of the existence of the afterlife, which is intriguing. But I'm just going to say, like I said, again, he does not go into not going to be things that people are going to associate with you know, that their curiosity is going to be satisfied by. But from a logical standpoint, it is very substantial. And this is what he states. He says that, I may have mentioned this last time, that just like the blind man cannot know what color is, and the deaf person cannot know what sound is, so too we cannot know what the experience of the afterlife is. Because in the afterlife, what happens is the soul is free from its relationship to the physical, to the instinctual. All right? Now, the question is, when it's freed, and I mentioned last time that that according to Maimonides, there's no such thing as a spiritual enjoyment in this world. In this world, every enjoyment is psychological. Psychological meaning, in some way or other, it's a manifestation of the instinct, either essential instinct or psychological. So the psychological is really like a derivative of the instinct, and every enjoyment that we perceive is basically of that nature. Now, in the next world, in the afterlife, when that part of man survives, which is eternal, does he have enjoyment or not? So Maimonides states, and this is basically the way he explains the concept, and of course it's backed up by the prophets. But let me just get to the idea. The prophet says, how great is the good that you have kept for those that fear you. Okay? Now, so we know from the prophets it is a great good. And the great good is something which is extremely enjoyable. Now, I'll just try to explain that. Now, the word enjoyment over here is something which we have to be careful with, because we associate enjoyment, you think, well, party, you see? Okay, but let's just look at it this way. The enjoyment over here, Maimonides says, is such a superior kind of enjoyment that a person who would have that experience would look down with disdain at every pleasure, every experience in his life, even the greatest pleasure. He would simply look down at that, and he wouldn't even want it. And he gives that as an example. He says, you see that people, when they get older, and this goes back to what we mentioned before, when a person gets older, they substitute psychological pleasures for physical ones. Psychological pleasures seem more important to them than physical ones. When they're younger, it's more physical. Kids are interested in more physical, playing, you know, food, having fun, watching television. But then when a person gets older, he's into more psychological pleasures. Being an important figure in a community, okay, gaining respect, money, more psychological pleasures. Now, the person, the grown-up, looks down at the other pleasures and would never be happy with them. If those were all the pleasures he could have, he'd be very unhappy. He looks at those as being inferior, but he has superior pleasures. And in the same manner, my mom, he says, but much, much more so, he says, if a person would experience the pleasure of the soul that the soul has in its function of knowledge and contemplation, he says the person would frown upon every other pleasure and look at it as if it's nothing, would have no desire for it. By the way, that's one of the reasons why in this life we could not possibly have a real spiritual enjoyment. Because if a person would have that, his free will would never be in existence anymore. Because that enjoyment is so superior that he would never be attracted to any other kind of psychological or instinctual pleasure. Because he would realize immediately how inferior it is. But it's part of the reason, part of the union of the soul with the man's physical makeup, that part of that union precludes any real spiritual enjoyment. Because the soul in this world is tied to the physical. And because it cannot have that enjoyment, we have free will. Because the soul functions and tells man what is true, but on the other hand, the physical pleasures keep drawing and gnawing at him, presenting him with another kind of reality, and man has to make the choice between the reality that is intelligence and his mind and his knowledge tells him is true, and between the reality that's being portrayed constantly by the world of the emotions. And those two pull on the person in two different directions, and that's where the free will comes in. Of course, you should be aware of a fact while I'm on the subject, that most people aren't really involved in free will, because the free will experience is only possible with knowledge. And that's why the Torah says that, behold, I gave to you this day life and death, and you shall choose life. Because before this day, the rabbis emphasize that, this day means before this day you really didn't have a choice. Why? Because if a person has no knowledge, then they're simply going to follow one emotion or another. That's not free will anymore. That's just psychological causality. There is a causation in psychology, and a person just left alone will do different things and even make different decisions, but these decisions are based on a tug of war between various emotions, and the one that comes out on top is going to determine what he does. But there is an experience of free will, and that is where the mind, and the Torah mind, the mind that has the knowledge, sees exactly what the good is, and the emotions try to portray another reality and distort the knowledge that he has in order to draw him into the sphere of the instinctual and away from the real good, which his mind perceives. And that's, again, another reason why, even though a person knows that God exists, he is constantly involved in that tug of war between those two worlds. So the knowledge of God is only the beginning, only the basis. That's why the prophet says the beginning of wisdom is the knowledge of God. That's the basis, because without that you can't move. And once you have that, then you start gaining knowledge, and the more knowledge you gain, the more free will you have, because the more you see what the real good is, and when the draw of the emotional good plays on a person's soul, he has to make that decision. Okay. All right. Now let's get back to this to the point that I was mentioning before, and that is that the soul, once it is freed from the body, finds itself in a new state of existence, a different kind of existence. Then the pleasures of the soul come into being, so to speak. Okay. Now, what can we say about that? We can demonstrate that there is such a thing as a part of man which can tune into eternity, to the eternal world. That's not hard to demonstrate. But when we're speaking about the pleasure or the enjoyment of that part, that becomes more difficult, because it is something, as the prophet says, only God has seen. No man has ever seen it, has ever experienced it. So only God knows what it is. But can we in some way have some insight into what that experience is like? The experience of the afterlife. Okay, that's a valid question. Now, it's interesting. Maimonides states that even though we could never, it seems to be state something which is contradictory. Like, he states that he states on the one hand a person can have no knowledge of it, but then he says a more intelligent person has more knowledge of it. Well, I mean, either you can or you can't have knowledge of it. What does Maimonides mean by those seemingly contradictory statements? Okay. That's what I'm going to clarify. That's what I'm trying to clarify now. Okay, to summarize briefly what we mean by the existence of the soul, we mean as follows. The existence of the soul can be demonstrated from the fact that in the universe there is a physical there that we can perceive with our senses, but behind the physical is the abstract world of ideas, and the world of ideas and laws of nature are what really govern nature. So everything is produced through ideas. Those ideas do not change; they are eternal. The human mind can tune into that world and recognizes that world as the real world. Now, that proves that there's something in the human mind that can partake of the eternal, which itself, of course, must be of the same nature. Therefore, that part of man is the eternal man, and the eternal part of man. And that's why that part is not subject to destruction, because it's not physical. That's really what we mean by the soul. Okay, and that's why we say that Tzelem Hashem Elokim, in Genesis, where it says that the divine image of man, that's what it means, the divine image, all the interpretations state that it means the knowledge and intelligence of man. Okay? Knowledge and intelligence, just like the... okay, so that is the part, that's the divine element of man, that's the part that's not subject to destruction. Okay? Now, I'd like to... To mention something, which I know sometimes it's a kind of a stumbling block. Like people say, well, you can have an intelligent person that knows physics and science, and yet it could be evil. All right, that is true. Nazis were evil, and yet they had science. But the answer to that question is, when we say knowledge, and this is important, when we say knowledge in the Torah, we mean knowledge with regard to everything, which means with regard to how a person should live. That is just as much knowledge, if not more important knowledge, more primary knowledge, than knowledge of the universe. Okay? And therefore, when we say a man lives according to knowledge, we mean in every way and in every respect. And there's a knowledge of ethics, which the Torah teaches us, and the knowledge of how to live, the proper way to live, and that knowledge is what, when we say knowledge, we mean total knowledge, okay? Not just the knowledge of a subject. A person could have knowledge of chess. This doesn't make him perfected. Knowledge of mathematics does not make him perfected. Even knowledge of physics doesn't make him perfected. But it's a part of the whole realm. When a person has total knowledge and recognizes the whole world of knowledge, including that part of knowledge which teaches a person how to live, that means that everything they do is based on knowledge, their whole life is surrounded by knowledge, then the soul is functioning completely, and then they will live according to the Torah. Okay? Now, what I'd like to do is just get back to this point, okay? The point is, a little bit abstract. The concept, it goes like this. That, and by the way, the good that we speak about is the soul's existence after death. That is the ultimate good, because that's when the soul's perception increases, and the depth of knowledge increases as well. That's why when God told Moses, he says, for man, Moses wanted to know God's essence, because he had reached such astronomical heights of knowledge. So he said, show me your essence. And God said, no, because man cannot know my essence and live. That meant to say that as long as he's alive and he's tied to the physical, he cannot reach that abstract level. But after he dies, then it is possible. It will be possible for Moses to perceive, to have a perception, not only of the actions of God, but even to some degree, of his essence. Okay. Now, because the soul is freed from the bonds of the physical. The physical is always a limitation in our life. It limits the power of the soul, the sight of the soul. And it removes this union, any kind of tending pleasure that the soul would have. Now, in the afterlife, the soul is freer. Its perception is clearer, better, more abstract, and also it gains the pleasure of its own function. Now, the way we could what Maimonides means is the answer to the contradiction I mentioned before is. That Maimonides means no one can know the afterlife because it's, the experience is impossible to have while we're alive. So you can't know it. That's what he means when he says no one can know it. But when he says that the greater a person is, the more of a knowledge of it he has, he means, because a person can have a knowledge of it by way of understanding. Not by way of experience, but by way of thought. Okay, now what I'm going to do is just go a little bit into that, because obviously, Maimonides means a real deep thinker will have a sound idea of this, and a person that isn't can have at least some concept of it. Okay. First of all, a person has to know what's meant by knowledge, because and that we've discussed. Because if you don't have a concept of what knowledge means, so then obviously you're not going to have any concept of what the afterlife is. All right? Now, there is, however, an example that we can give, which would, by way of a example, you'll be able to see a little bit as to what is meant by the afterlife. If you notice, every creature has, when it functions properly, has an attending enjoyment. In other words, if you take a cow and you give it its needs, so it is in a pleasurable state, all right? If you take a human being and give him his needs, he will also be in a pleasurable state. Now, the pleasurable state of the human being is far superior to the pleasurable to the pleasure of a cow. Everyone recognizes that an animal might be a contented, you see, we call it contented, really, but man is capable of extreme excitement and pleasure, all right? And that's because man is a superior, a higher form of existence than an animal. That's why he's capable of a higher kind of enjoyment and pleasure. The lower you go in the animal world, the lower the concept of pleasure is. The higher, the closer to man, the closer. But there's a big then all of a sudden you reach a tremendous gap. When you reach let's say the primates, okay. So you reach a higher level of animal behavior and existence, but then there's that big gap between any animal and the human being with his mind and his intelligence and his different inner experiences. The inner experiences of man are far wealthier. They're actually different, completely different than the inner experiences of animals, and there is a greater enjoyment because there is more psychic energy. It's a higher kind of existence. Now the soul itself is the highest existence. So all Maimonides is saying is that that everything that exists, when it functions properly, has an attending enjoyment, an enjoyment that is with it, that experiences. The higher the existence, the higher the enjoyment. And the soul, which is qualitatively differentiated, must have the highest kind of satisfaction when it functions freely. Therefore, man in the afterlife, when it's just the soul functioning, okay, experiences the greatest satisfaction, which is a satisfaction which is qualitatively differentiated from other satisfactions that we experience, which are psychological satisfactions. And in this way, a person can at least get some kind of a vision of what is meant by the enjoyment that exists in the afterlife. It's the satisfaction that attends a higher kind of existence, which is man's soul. Okay? Man's psyche is higher than the animal, and that's why it's capable of more pleasure, but man's soul is qualitatively differentiated, because the psyche is really just variations of the instinct. But the soul is a pure existence, something which is tied to the eternal, completely different, and when that functions freely, the attending enjoyment and satisfaction supersedes qualitatively any kind of experience of enjoyment that we could have in this life. Okay, so in that way, we could present some kind of an inkling and some kind of an approach as to what we mean by what the prophet means when he says, what is this great good? How great is the good that you have hidden for those that fear you? That is the great good, and only God knows what that good is. Man, through his mind, can get an inkling of it, but he's kind of like a construct, sort of, but he can't really have a direct knowledge of what it is. Okay? So, in this way, we come to understand in an intelligent way what the Torah means by an afterlife. I'd like to just show you from the Torah itself, from the prophet itself, what is meant by an afterlife, and we have clear allusions to it, if you just use your intelligence to understand the verses. But first, I want to deal with a major question. All right. Now, this major question I'm dealing with is not just a question for those who believe in the truth of Torah, but it's question that has really stunned every person who's tried to analyze Torah, whether they were historians or religionists or mythologists, any people that approach Torah, are always stunned by one amazing fact, and that is that the Torah mentions nothing overtly. The five books of Moses mentions nothing about an afterlife. Okay? Now, at one time, historians thought, well, it's very simple. You see, the rabbis made up this idea of an afterlife centuries later. But originally, in the original Torah, there was never a concept of an afterlife. And these are historians who do not believe that the Torah is true, but they certainly don't believe that the rabbis... From the most primitive, I mean, from the American Indians with the happy hunting grounds, from the most primitive, I don't mean that that's the most primitive, there are more primitive religions, but the most primitive religion always has an afterlife. And at the time when the historians made this, conclusion, they drew that conclusion, they weren't aware of it. But then as they studied other religions, they found out that there aren't any religions that don't have an afterlife. And once psychoanalysis started to investigate it, it was discovered that an afterlife is part of man's unconscious mind. It's part of man's primitive mind. It's the fantasy of immortality, which exists in every single human being, with the exclusion of none. Just like there are no people without a heart, there are no people without an unconscious, which has a fantasy of immortality. And immortality is expressed on a daily basis in numerous ways. Every person has that fantasy that they're immortal. But now, once that's known, now we have a very, very big problem. Because if the Torah is not the Word of God, it would come out that somehow these people living 3,000 years ago were able to avoid the most primary reason that people are religious. And it just sounds crazy. How could these people deny such a thing? Why would they deny such a thing when everybody else in the world accepts it? And that's the main motivation of all religious life. Is really, they sell you heaven. Heaven is what religion is selling. How could Torah be exempt from that? Psychologically, it does not make any sense. All right? So it's a dilemma, really, for the person who studies the Torah and who believes the Torah is true, but it's a big dilemma, unanswerable dilemma, for the person who doesn't believe the Torah is true and tries to study the Torah purely from an historical standpoint. Okay. Now, what do we say to this great problem? It's a problem for those who accept the truth of Torah also. Why didn't the Torah mention anything about an afterlife? When we understand what afterlife means, you'll see why the Torah never mentioned it. Okay? And this is precisely everything we've been discussing the past 3 weeks now kicks in and as part of the answer, you see, to this big dilemma. And the answer really is based on what we said, straightforward, quite straightforward. The answer is, you have to remember that although Maimonides explains that people do things for ulterior motives, and you don't always remove the ulterior motive until you can supply them with a true motive. Now, that's just common sense, okay? If a person is following a doctor's advice for the wrong reason, and if you know if you tell him it's wrong, he's not going to do it, you don't say anything. You let him go on until he gains enough intelligence to know that the physician is the one that has the answer for him. Same thing is true in Torah. That's purely logical. But you must remember that the Torah is the Word of God, and everything in the Torah can only be true. Okay? Now, if the Torah would have mentioned an afterlife, then what would happen? People, when they saw afterlife, they would immediately think not the true afterlife of that requires speculation, all right? The afterlife that we've been discussing, Maimonides explains, but they would immediately think that there's something better than the Torah itself. That the Torah is not saying to do the good because this is really the good. The Torah is saying to do the good, why? Because you're going to get paid back in an afterlife. They're going to think of an afterlife which is what you suffered in this life. Okay? That would be false. If God would have written that in the Torah, then man would be living a false life. Okay? Man would be, perhaps he may even do the commandments with greater fervor if God would have. No doubt, if God would have written that in the Torah, it would be more inspiring. But that's not true. And because it's not true, the Torah did not wish to influence man with a false notion. Because then people would think the good is not the Torah itself. The good is something that God's going to give me in return for suffering and for keeping these laws. But the Torah tries to make it perfectly clear that the laws themselves are the good. Now that is true, because the laws are good for man in this world as well as for his soul, because since his soul is perfected, so the soul continues its existence in the hereafter. But you don't even need the hereafter in order to keep the Torah, because the good of the Torah is good right here and now. This is the only way to live a good life, a life based upon knowledge and the system that God gave man. So that is the reason why the Torah avoided mentioning anything about an afterlife. Now you have to look at it this way, a little further. The Jews had come out of Egypt, okay? The Jewish people came out of Egypt. What was the main preoccupation of Egypt? The main preoccupation of Egypt was death, afterlife. Everything in Egypt rang from an afterlife in one way or another. The pyramids, everything that was done, servants were taken with them into the afterlife. Giant tombs were built for the wealthy people, the people of high status who were able to afford such a thing. And the other people, no doubt, looked on with envy. But everything was done in return for an afterlife. So their religion was based on this concept. The Torah took the Jewish people, God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, away from this kind of living where people did things for death, and he gave them a Torah which taught people to do things for life because this is good. So the major thrust was to show man, and that's the thrust of the Torah, to show man that the good is in itself the good. That's why the Torah says in many places, you'll do the commandments. Why? L'tov loch, so that it should be good for you. This is the good. There is before you death and life. Choose life. It means if you do this, then you're partaking of life. So a person who keeps Torah does not keep Torah because of an afterlife. That would be saying that there's a compensation for everything I'm doing, which means I'm doing things which are not really good. I'm just doing them because I want to get a greater compensation. But that's not true. The truth is that the Torah, which is the true system, teaches man to do this because it is good for you. If you don't do it, you're harming yourself. Okay? That is why the Torah never mentioned an afterlife, because it didn't want to mislead people and cause people to do things for an untrue reason. That would be harmful, you see. That would be harmful. So the Torah told man the true reason. Do things because of the good itself. However, that's enough reason to do it. The concept of an afterlife is a deep philosophical one. The Torah does not expound overtly on deep philosophical principles. That was left for the oral law. The oral portion of the Torah is the part that deals with the more abstract science. The science of Torah is always in the oral law. So there you have derivations from verses and allusions and the whole system of the oral law. But the Torah itself overtly does not deal with abstract concepts, because it's made for every, even a casual reader, to be able to read through it and it makes sense, okay, on a basic level. But the deeper level is where the oral law comes in, and that's why the concept of an afterlife, which is a very deep philosophical concept, with the 3 weeks that we've been discussing it, we're just scratching the surface of it, and the Torah does not write, record such kinds of ideas, because that's not for the written law, that's the area of the oral law. Okay. Just give me a second. Are there any questions?
I don't think we have questions. I could just add a a qualifying statement
yes.
In there in relation to the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach,
mm-hmm.
that there's nothing in them dealing with the afterlife.
That's correct.
Because in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, the emphasis is on the here and now and quality of life for all of humanity in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And by bringing ourselves under the control of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, then we are actually elevating ourselves in the spiritual
mm-hmm.
realm,
mm-hmm.
or elevating the soul, as you've been, saying. So.
That's correct. I would just add one thing, and I remember what I wanted to add, and that is, however, allusions to it. And I don't mean just allusions, but I mean open statements which are unexplainable unless one understands the idea of an afterlife. That you do find in Torah. Of course, it's in Ecclesiastes, as I mentioned before, it mentions that the soul returns to God, the body stays in the earth. But aside from that, in Psalms, you always find a term, and in the Torah, in another place, you find a term, Sheol. Sheol. What does Sheol mean? David says, God will not allow me to go into Sheol. And Sheol is used many times in Psalms, as I'm sure you're all familiar with. Now, what is this Sheol? No one seems to know what it is. Historians, Bible critics say, well, it's the grave. Well, was King David stupid? Did he think he's not going to die? I mean, it doesn't seem so. On the contrary, he seemed to be very, very realistic when his death approached. He called Solomon and he instructed him and he said, I'm dying. If I accept the death, what does it mean? Does it mean that he went to the Sheol? What is Sheol really? See, Sheol is a vague concept. But the idea of Sheol, and there are no descriptions of a Hades or a hellfire or anything like that. What Sheol means is what Maimonides explains, and that is, you see, Sheol implies destruction. What it means is the soul that has not elevated itself, it simply disintegrates with the body, and that's it. It's God. That is Sheol. Sheol means when if a person's essence is just the physical, then at the time that he dies, there is nothing that survives. Everything just goes into the grave, and that's it. So Sheol does mean a pit and a grave. But what King David was saying is that God will not allow me to die in a way that my soul has not reached its proper perfection so that it can continue to exist. That is what he means by when he mentions that God saves him from Sheol. And it's the same thing that he means when he speaks about his enemies, and he says that God will not allow his enemies to prevail over him because God will save him from Sheol. He doesn't mean from an immediate death, because if a person does not get killed by his enemies, he's still not going to live for much longer. I mean, the man's in his 50s, it's 20, 30 years maybe. So he's not going to escape. What he means is what the Torah says. Because the Torah says, Maimonides explains this, that when the Torah speaks about the punishment that the Jewish people will suffer if they don't abide by the laws of the Torah, so Maimonides explains that these punishments are not in themselves bad. What's bad about them is they prevent the person from spending their time properly in pursuing the perfection of the soul. Because if a person is being chased by their enemies, and if a person is sick, and a person has all kinds of problems, then their day is spent just trying to survive, and not much time, he doesn't have any time or much time to spend on perfecting the soul. Then the person goes down to Sheol, because there is nothing left that survives. You see, that's what King David meant when he spoke. And that's what he meant when he says also that the dead cannot praise God. What does it mean, the dead cannot praise God? Well, of course, the person's dead. Does he mean physically? Does he mean that there's nothing survives the grave? No. What he meant was praising God means where a person is perfecting his soul in this world through his proper attitude towards God, his recognition of God. In the next world, it's a different kind of a state. The next world is a state where the perfection that the individual gained in this world remains with him. The afterlife is a result of this life. But you cannot make any gains in that, and you cannot make any qualitative gains understand that concept, then when you read Psalms, you'll see how it fits, how it all fits in. The praising of God, for instance, and we mentioned that once before, it uses that special name, the abbreviated name, the Y and the H, because that is the name that is used to direct one's emotions away from the instinctual and towards the recognition of God. That kind of phenomenon only exists in this life. In this life, we have the choice to redirect the energies towards the true source of all existence, God. In the next world, you don't have that choice anymore. Then whatever you have established in your soul, that is the level that the person stays on eternally. They have different experiences. It doesn't mean it's a static kind of a thing. The next world is not the afterlife is not a static kind of a thing. It's an activity, but the activity can only reach a certain realm, a certain qualitative realm. That realm is the realm which a person has accomplished with his soul in this life. Okay, so that is what is meant throughout by the term by that term Sheol.
Rabbi, okay. We got less than a minute, and hope we don't run out this time.
I'm really finished.
Okay, well, that's good.
Okay.
Well, we'll cut you off then. not to Sheol, though.
Okay. All right. By the way, next week, I won't be giving class. Next week is Purim.
Right.